Evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? Way in the back, can you hear? Okay, good. If you are here for the first time for this particular series, we're just going to spend Sunday evenings for about 50 minutes just telling stories. I've been around a long time, and I know a lot of stories, and maybe out of these, you'll get a different way of looking at our steps. We will be going through the steps, but this is not a step class. It's not a workshop on the steps. And as I said last week, if anything I say is different from what your sponsor says, you just pay attention to your sponsor. I'm just going to share some of the history of AA and how I see these spiritual principles in my life today. And hopefully we'll have a lot of fun, and maybe we'll learn a few things. As I said last week, AA's birthday is today. And there's a big celebration going on out in Akron, Ohio. And this is a very historic day for those of us that keep track of AA history. And I'll talk a little bit about it as we get going. I also said that the 12 steps are best described in the foreword to the 12 and 12 by Bill when he called them a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, will do two things. It'll get rid of the obsession with alcohol and enable you to become happily and usefully whole. So being a complete person and being a happy person is what the 12 principles are designed to give you. And I've been saying this for 30 years. If you're an AA, been in here a while, and you're working the steps and you're not happy, you're doing it wrong. Because they're designed to enable us to have an underlying sense of joy and happiness, even when sad events are happening. In other words, they coexist. We always have that sense of optimism, even as we're going through losing a job or a relationship or parents or whatever it is. There's that eternal sense that everything's fine, in spite of the seeming evidence to the contrary. And so that's what's in store for you. And if you're new, I wish you the best of luck. And I hope you get as excited and enthusiastic about it as a lot of us are, because it never wears off. And I've been enthusiastic for 40-some years, and it just doesn't go away. It's here. It would go away if I stopped coming here and stopped being plugged into it, but I have no intention of doing that. So, somebody sent me something today talking about history. As you know my story, I came in the 1960s, and I was a Marine pilot, and the Navy was in charge of all of our medical needs. And it was the Dark Ages as far as alcoholism was concerned. And what I was sent was a notice that a Navy doctor, age 93, had just passed away, and his name is Joe Zuska. And what he did, he was a doctor all the way back to the World War II, the Battle of Tarawa, Saipan, and was on a hospital ship during the Incheon landings. And he ended up in Long Beach in the 60s. And a retired Navy commander was visiting with him, who was a recovered alcoholic in AA. And he asked him what the Navy was doing for alcoholics. And he said, nothing. The policy at that time was in the mid-60s in the Navy, alcoholism was punishable by time in the brig. That was the treatment of alcoholism. And so when he saw what was going on and the fact that the Navy at the same time encouraged a lot of drinking, he thought that something ought to be done. And I'll read these paragraphs. Though the program, which he thought up, had not been approved by Navy officials, Ziska began holding weekly meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in a conference room at the Naval Station in Long Beach, then moved to a Quonset hut where the number of participants grew. He found an 80-bed barracks, turned it into an inpatient recovery facility. Word soon spread that lives are being changed, and higher-ups in the Navy found out about it. The brass was alarmed for two reasons. According to policy, there were no alcoholics in the Navy. And therefore, there was no need for a treatment program. And also, there were quite a few alcoholic admirals and generals on active duty at the Pentagon that were getting very nervous about someone starting an alcohol program. But they went out to investigate his illegal alcohol program and found out how much good it was doing. And in 1967, the Pentagon gave official approval for Alcohol Rehabilitation Center. And the Navy jumped to the lead in terms of treating military alcoholics. And I just wanted to mention that because it's hard to imagine that I was back there, and if you were an alcoholic, the only thing available was the brig. So you had to hide it, and when I did go in, I was sent into the nut ward, and AA found me. We ended up last time talking about Bill's spiritual experience in Towns Hospital, Bill Wilson being one of our co-founders and the main author of most of the materials that we share today. And in that experience, Bill had the desire to drink lifted out of him while he was in the hospital and barely sober. And he never drank again. And out of that experience called the spiritual awakening came two things. One, the freedom from the obsession with alcohol. And two, an absolute necessity to pass this message on. He couldn't restrain himself. The transformation was so exciting, he just knew that he had to give it away. Which is part of our whole program, all happening in one awakening. And so he went out immediately when he was released from the hospital to sober alcoholics up. And he went around to the bars. I mean, what did he have to talk about? Well, what he had to talk about was this huge spiritual awakening. And so everywhere he went, he talked about this big moment and the lights in the mountaintop and God was there. And, you know, if you're in the bar talking to an alcoholic who's having a few drinks about the mountaintop and the lights and all that, you're really not going to get too many takers. People would say, well, I get that when I drink rum. I'm very familiar with that experience. And so try as he would, he couldn't get anybody interested in his great recovery until he went back and talked to Dr. Silkworth, who was the doctor at Towns Hospital, a psychiatrist who by accident got into the alcohol business. He was a very prospering psychiatrist, and the crash of 1929 put him out of business. And Towns, that owned Towns Hospital, was not a doctor. He was a profiteer. And he got him over there and used his skills with alcoholics. And that's how he just took it, because there was no other job. But it's lucky he got there. So he told Bill, he said, you know, I don't think that hot flash story is going to work. So what you have to talk to alcoholics about is the dead-end nature of the disease. You have to tell them that if they keep drinking, they're going to just keep going down, 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 and make it so awful that they're ready to surrender. And so you could see how our steps got put in sequence right there. He was starting out with the 12th step, spiritual awakening, and ended up putting that at the very end. And as we talked about last week, we talked about our first step being the most important one anywhere. Because unless we can accept all the way down to our very core that we are powerless over alcohol, and unless something spiritual helps us, we will never make it. And whatever bad things have happened so far, much worse things are going to happen in the future. And so when that is fully explained and each one of us breaks through our denial, when we all arrive here, we go, oh yeah, I got a drinking problem, but I'm not quite the same as some of these hopeless jerks. Mine is more situational. My boss was mean to me, and if you were married to the woman I'm married to, you would drink a lot too. But I'm getting a divorce. That's going to take the pressure off, so I won't be drinking this much. You understand how you talk yourself out of being an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, because the hopeless variety has to do the steps. And nobody wants to do the steps. I mean, so I want to be almost hopeless. So I'll just hit some meetings, go out to lunch, and that ought to carry me. Carry me, carry me. And we find out it carries us to the grave. But we all go through the game of pretending that things aren't as bad as they are. And as a matter of fact, some of us arrive here and we're not even alcoholics. And we become alcoholics while attending meetings. How could that happen? You come here and you're not an alcoholic. You go to about 25 meetings and you go, you know something? I am an alcoholic and have been one for 20 years. How could that happen? We got honest. We finally got honest with ourselves and we took a close look and we saw this was indeed a terrible situation. So that's where we left off last week, that our co-founder, Bill Wilson, had this miraculous experience and something inside of him was not going to let him stop carrying the message. That was quite a blessing to have that event happen so that he was committed to do this. Now, I think we mentioned that he grew up in Vermont and the chain of events that led to him receiving a message from his sponsor, Ebby Thatcher, and going to the Oxford Group, which was a spiritual movement that preceded AA. I think I mentioned last week that this was a group of people. A Lutheran minister decided that the church was screwing it all up and we ought to eliminate the middleman and we'll just meet in our homes and talk spiritual things and we can help each other get more spiritual. And it really caught on. And I thought it was interesting, along those lines, I was reading a book where Dr. Jung was quoted, and I'd never seen this quote before from Carl Jung. And someone asked him, what was the main purpose of religion? And he said, the main purpose of religion is to prevent people from having direct contact with God themselves. You go to church and the church has the contact and you chip the money in and they'll take care of you and the contact will occur later on. Later on, you will actually have contact. And of course, that's the difference with AA, is that we are working on contact with our own Creator. Direct personal contact, as opposed to a lot of knowledge about the Creator. You follow what I'm saying? AA doesn't have any of that knowledge. We just have 12 suggested principles which will establish your own contact and you will have your own experience, and that becomes the foundation of your life. Well, anyway, Bill is about to go back to work, try to earn a living and recoup from the terrible situation they're in. And he gets sent out after about 5 months sobriety to Akron, Ohio, where we run into the second key player in our lives, Dr. Bob Smith. And oddly enough, he was also from Vermont. So both of the co-founders came from Vermont, which is way up in the northeastern part of the country. And whenever I'm in California, I love to remind them that the greatest social movement on planet Earth didn't start in California. And you know what I hear? They go, "Yeah, but it was going nowhere till we got it." And then we really got it going. It was going nowhere till California AA's got it. Now, in all fairness, they are really fired up out there. So it's really... But of all places, the drinking capital of the world, Vermont. You just wouldn't ever put that in a Hollywood movie. Let's have both guys come from Vermont. But they did. Now, Dr. Bob was 16 years older than Bill. And his father was a judge, and he grew up in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, further north. And Bill was down in Manchester and East Dorset. And Dr. Bob was a good student, and he went to Dartmouth College. And while he was there, he learned about drinking. Dartmouth still has that wonderful reputation of... Party, party, party. But he graduated. He hadn't really picked up the pace where it was screwing up his life yet. And he decided to be a doctor. And so he went to Michigan to a Michigan University to go to the medical school. And he lasted about 4 months and had to drop out because due to drinking he couldn't possibly keep up with his studies. So he went back to Vermont and took about 4 months off and came back and registered in a different college called Rush and was in that medical school. And at the end of about 6 months, his father came and got him and brought him back to Vermont. This was a pattern that he had. His father would rescue him, take him back and watch him so he couldn't drink, and then send him back into action. But he eventually graduated from medical school and was lucky to get an internship in Akron, Ohio. And he started his practice, and for the first couple years, he really didn't drink that much. He got involved with his practice and was building it, etc. But then he just lost total control and had to go back to Vermont again. And again, he stayed like 6 months with his father, and then came back, stayed sober about a year, and then just started in terrible. He was hospitalized probably three times as much as Bill. But he wouldn't get it bad because he had to perform surgery. Bill would go all the way down till he was a babbling idiot on the floor and then go in just before he died, whereas Dr. Bob was going more frequently. But it was a really hopeless situation. And right around 1931, a funny event happened with the Firestones. Everybody knows Firestone Tires and Harvey Firestone, the multimillionaire, and all of that. Well, it turns out that a gentleman from Florida went out there. He was from Fort Myer, and he was a member of the Oxford Group. And he went out there as a special secretary to Harvey Firestone. And he noticed that Firestone's son, Bud, was an alcoholic. He was just drunk all the time. And so he talked to him, and he said, "You know, I'm in this Oxford Group, and I've seen alcoholics get sober in Oxford." Which was happening. Bill Wilson was one of them, and Ebby. And so he said, "Why don't you come with me to an Oxford Group meeting and see if you like it?" So he went to this meeting out of state, and I forget where it was, and when they came back, his son stayed sober. Bud Firestone stayed sober. So after a couple of years, his father said, well, we ought to get that Oxford crowd here in Akron. And the Oxford group liked celebrities. They liked that whole idea. If you had celebrities, that would attract more people to come into the movement. So when Harvey Firestone, it was a big public relations deal. It was the social event of the year. The Oxford people are coming. And even Sam Shoemaker came. And they took over the Willard Hotel, or the Mayflower Hotel, and they had a huge deal. And because of all that publicity, Dr. Bob's wife, Ann Smith, and Henrietta Seiberling, who become important players in our history, went to see what it was all about, and they liked it. And they started attending. And it was very beneficial to their lives, and they had quite a solid group there in Akron. And after a year or so, Ann Smith said to her husband, you ought to come with me to this Oxford group meetings. We meet at once a week, and you could come, and they have had success with alcoholics, and I think it would help you. So Dr. Bob went for 2 years and really enjoyed all of the Oxford principles. He loved all the people, and he got everything down except the not drinking part. And he just stayed in terrible shape. They were all praying for him. They were all worried about him. And you can see how important that preparation was for another Oxford grouper to arrive in Akron on a business deal, and that was Bill Wilson. There was a machine company that made tools to make rubber, and it was in some trouble, and there was two groups that were trying to get it. And Bill was sent out there as an emissary from one group from Wall Street to see if they could take control of this company. And Bill was promised that if they won, he would be the president of the company. And so all the way out there, he is planning pay off all the debts, join the country club, I'll have the new car, I'll be playing golf again. He loved golf. My wife will be happy. She won't have to work in the department store. Amazing. Alcoholics sometimes have these expectations. And they've got their whole future planned over a proxy fight. You follow what I'm saying? Man, I'm on my way to being rich again. This is great. So he's out there with about 5.5, 6 months sobriety. And he starts this thing that only takes a little while, and they lose the fight. So now, he's broke. He was broke when he got there, and he's still broke. He can hardly pay the hotel bill. And he feels like maybe all this spirituality isn't working that good. He starts getting a little negative. He starts thinking to himself, this isn't fair. I'm trying as hard as I can to stay sober. I'm doing everything I can, and look what happens to me. Nobody seems to care about my family and all the trouble I'm in. Maybe, and he's listening to the bar people in the Mayflower Hotel, and he can hear the music, and the crowd is in there laughing. He said, maybe I ought to just go in there and have a few drinks of gin and be king for a day. But he starts recognizing how frightening that thought is. Because you know when that thought takes hold and then it starts getting going. So he decided right there that the only way he was going to stay sober was to find another alcoholic to help. And many people say that that was one of the real origins of Alcoholics Anonymous. When an alcoholic realized that for him to stay sober himself, he'd have to go out and find another alcoholic to help. So he picked up the phone and he made these phone calls to people who become part of our history. Reverend Tunks was the minister who had set up the whole Oxford group thing in the first place. And he referred him to another man named Shepherd who gave him some numbers of the Oxford group people, including Henrietta Seiberling of the Seiberling Rubber Company. And she and Ann Smith were very close. And Bill called up and said, "I'm an Oxford grouper from New York, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. I need somebody to help." And Henrietta Seiberling said, "My God, we've been praying for Dr. Bob to have something rescue him." And it's rumored that she said, "Yes, we've been expecting your call." Possible a little poetic license there. But in any event, she very excitedly called Ann Smith and said, "Get Dr. Bob over here. This is the moment. The man is here to save him." And Ann said, "Well, I don't think he can be saved today. Saving will have to wait till tomorrow." Because he went out to get me a Mother's Day plant, and the plant is under the table, and he's passed out on the bed. So he had to wait till the next day, and they got Dr. Bob up, and he slept most of the day, a terrible hangover, just not feeling good. And his wife is nagging him to go see some guy from New York who wants to talk to him about alcoholism. And he doesn't, you can imagine, you know, Sunday afternoon, you don't want to go talk to anybody. And on the way over to the gatehouse where Henrietta Seiberling lived, he promised her that he would talk for 15 minutes. And they sat down and talked for 5.5 hours. One drunk talking to another. And Dr. Bob was astounded. He didn't know anyone else felt like he did. He didn't know anyone else told the same lies. He didn't know anyone else drank like he did. He couldn't believe his eyes. I mean, this guy was like looking in the mirror, and the mirror's talking back. So there was that instant identification of one alcoholic talking to another. And they talked, and they talked, and they talked. And Henrietta Seiberling got Bill temporary quarters in one of the country clubs out there for about 5 days. Somebody paid off his bill in the Mayflower. When the week was up, he went to live with Dr. Bob because he didn't have any money. And the two of them started trying to sober people up right away. They went down and tried to get one doctor, and that didn't work out. And after about 8 or 9 days of this, Dr. Bob decided that as he thought about his life, he was way behind on his medical education. And there was an American Medical Association convention in Atlantic City. And maybe he ought to just get on that train and go over there and catch up on some of the courses that he missed. And, of course, as soon as he got on the train, he's drunk. And he goes to Atlantic City and stays drunk and comes back. And on June 10th, they dumped him out of the railroad car on the platform and called his wife to come get him, and they carried him home. So AA's birthday is in celebration of Dr. Bob lying on the railroad station having had AA's first slip, although it wasn't AA yet. And Dr. Bob never had another drink. Bill got him up. He had to perform surgery. He gave him one beer to calm him down and some kind of a goofball pill to steady his hands. And he went in there, performed the surgery, and they said, and Bill waited with his wife, and he said, "Now come on home and tell us how it went." Well, the surgery was in the morning, and pretty soon it's noon, he's not home. It's 3 p.m, he's not home. It's like 5 p.m, he finally comes in. They worried that he went back to drinking. And they asked him, "Where have you been?" And he said, "When I finished the surgery and I thought about my life, I realized that my drinking had hurt a lot of people here in Akron. So I went around and made amends to them all." That may be the record for how soon you do your ninth step after your last drink, because he did it the same day. But in any event, that started the beginning of one alcoholic helping another, and we'll pick up on that next week and see how they started working there in Akron and simultaneously back in New York. But now we get back to the principles, and having established in our first step that we are powerless absolutely over alcohol, we're confronted with something that generally drives all of us new people crazy, and that is the concept of a higher power, of God. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I remember that, and of course, as soon as they brought it up, I liked the AA people, I liked my sponsor, I was having fun, we're going to meetings, and then we came to, okay, now let's sit down, Sandy, and talk about God. And I just said, I don't think we want to do that. I'm not comfortable with that. I just don't feel like I want to do that. And so that's what our second step is all about, is how to get out of that box that we've been in with regard to this thing called God, or spirit of the universe, or higher power, or whatever name we want to give it. Many, even way back in the beginning, they would say, well, then just make the AA group your higher power. They are certainly know more than you do about alcoholism, and you could certainly rely on them while you're trying to wrestle with this problem that you have in your mind about something bigger than yourself. And so, as Bill writes the literature, he's addressing all the different types of us that arrive here. Because one type that arrives here is somebody who's going to church all the time and prays and does novenas and says rosaries and is drunk all the time. So they create the illusion that relying on God doesn't work. I'm down there all the time. I'm talking to the priest and I'm doing this and I'm drunk. So no sense for me to try this God stuff. I'm already trying it and it doesn't work. Well, as it turns out, he's not really trying it. He's going through the motions. He's saying the words and he's showing up so that people will think that he's really trying. But in his heart, he has never really given spirituality a fair trial. Now, that's a funny thing for us who like to claim that we're very logical. We like the scientific thing, not the spiritual stuff. I want to see it on a blackboard. Well, scientific experiments are designed to see what kind of results we get. So anybody with an open mind wouldn't mind performing experiments to see what might happen. And most of us have never given spirituality an experiment. We've never had an open mind. Okay, you really want me to try this? We wrote it off without trying it because we're very smart. And we knew that if I did try it, it wouldn't work, so why try it? Anybody think that way? Some of us are so smart, we know what the experiment will produce without doing it. The reason I don't pray is I already know if I prayed, nothing would happen. So why should I pray if nothing's going to happen? I thought that way all the time. I thought it was really smart. And I found out that was not smart. It was stupid. That's what that was. And so then there may be someone who doesn't know anything about God, churches, nothing. They have no experience whatsoever. And so Bill said, well, how are we going to approach that person? Well, one of the strongest cases we have is to explain the situation to them, which he does in the beginning of step two in the big book. Now, if you're new, step two is not numbered in the big book. It's called the chapter to the agnostic. We agnostics, of all places to place finding God, is in the chapter we agnostics. When my sponsor gave me a big book and he said, "Now everything you need to know is in here," and all of that, and I looked at it and I just said, "Yeah." I mean, it was hard for me to believe it was going to solve any of my problems. But I did notice the chapters of the agnostic, and I went through it and I made some marks. I think I mentioned that last time, and underlined a few things, so it would look like I read it. When he came over to talk to him, I was reading this. This is really cool right here. I like this. But you don't think I was going to take it seriously, do you? I knew what my problems were, and I knew what was necessary. Money. That was the heart of all of my problems. And so when I saw the chapter of the agnostic, I said, being smart, I said, "I know what that is. That's the chapter that tells the agnostics how to stay sober. It obviously doesn't include any steps." So I knew I was going to eventually go to that chapter and find out how the agnostic stayed sober. And of course, when you read the chapter, it says, "Hey, if you're an agnostic, change your mind. Become a former agnostic." Well, why should I do that? Why should I change my mind about spirituality and higher powers? Why should I change my mind? Said, "Well, maybe you ought to read this." And the first paragraph in that chapter says, "If when you drink, you have little control over the amount you drink." Okay, that's everybody. "And if when you stop, you can't stay stopped." Okay, that's everybody. "Then you may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will help." You're suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will help. And I think I said last time, I told my sponsor, "Well, I don't believe in spiritual experiences." He says, "Well, then you're screwed." This is the situation that you're in. And then it goes on to say, "To die an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face." That's the quote out of the big book. And so if we had someone new here and you're struggling with spirituality, alcoholism, spirituality, we might make it into a quiz show. And we might invite you up. You know how they do that on the quiz shows and everything. "And so you want to be an alcoholic? Come on up. And we got two doors back here, Joe." And Joe standing out in front. "And you got to choose one of them." "All right, all right. Now, let me show you door number one, die an alcoholic death. You want that door?" "No, I don't want that door, Sandy. Is there another door?" "Yeah. Live on a spiritual basis. Which door do you want?" And if you're like the rest of us, you're going to stand there with your arms crossed, thinking. Alcoholic death, spiritual basis, sounds like two pretty bad choices to me. I don't like either one of them. Is there a third door? No, there's only two doors. Do I get a phone call? Yes, you get a phone call. So you call the family doctor. And, "Hey, doctor, this is Joe. Listen, a friend of mine's curious. How bad's an alcoholic? Oh, God, it's really bad." "Okay, I'll do spiritual basis. How's that for a scenario on how to get spiritual?" "Okay, I'll do door number two." "Now, why'd you choose door number two?" "Because door number one is worse. We're getting spiritual by default. We don't even believe in it. But there's nowhere else to go." So then we go, "Okay." And this is the beginning of spirituality. "Okay, maybe I'll try it." Now, you know what that maybe is? It's the beginning of open-mindedness. "Maybe I'll try some of this." Okay, so what can we look at that would help us in that situation? And I'll tell you what I had to look at that was wonderful, and we don't have enough of it today. When I got sober up in Washington, D.C., we had 7 speaker meetings for every discussion meeting. And every speaker meeting had 2 speakers, like we have at Saturday night or Thursday night over here. So 90% of the time, I was sitting in the audience listening to 2 stories. And all the stories said, I was hopeless, and they told me how bad off it was, and now I'm doing great. And it's because I changed my mind about a higher power. And then the next speaker got up. And pretty soon some guy got up who was just like me. Just like me. I wouldn't touch that guy. I came in here and, okay, I'll try that stupid stuff. Hey, it worked. I'm so happy. Everything's wonderful. What was in front of me was a steady collection of proof that I could not deny. That's the power of speaker meetings. You sit out there and you hear this story, and it's worse than yours. And sometimes I would hear these stories and I'd go, well, this person didn't get straightened out. That's a hopeless case. And then they would tell me, so I changed my mind. I tried this spiritual stuff. And my God, I got my health back, my family, and now I'm doing this, and now I'm doing that. And so this is what enables us to see spirituality. It's no longer a theory. We have visual proof right in front of us that this person, just like myself, somehow changed their mind about this God thing, and the rest is history. It's all right there in front of my eyes. And so we come back and look what it says. It says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore our sanity. That is what the process of coming to believe looks like. We just keep an open mind, and then we watch. And we see changes taking place. And then maybe you start seeing them in yourself. You go, I don't understand why I feel so terrible. I go to the noon meeting at Yana, and I feel better when I come out. Why is that? All they're doing is talking junk in there. Why should I feel better? I don't know. Come up with an explanation. Could it be that there really is something called spiritual energy that heals people? Could it really be true that it's healing you? I remember when I first felt better, it made me nervous. I mean, you mean this stuff might work? I mean, part of the thing I was afraid of, what if I prayed and it worked? Boy, would I look stupid. I've been bad-mouthing prayer for 25 years. All my friends will give me a hard time. They'll go, you were wrong. And, of course, alcoholics hate being wrong. I mean, I'd rather be right than anything. As long as I'm right, I won the argument. Rather be right than happy. Yeah, I just like being right. Where do we get that rule? I want to be right. We have a whole program, as you're going to find out, where the real name of the game is being wrong. Hey, I'm wrong about that. Boom, get rid of it. It's the ticket to freedom. Oh, wrong again. Boom. But in the beginning, for an alcoholic to admit he's wrong is like turning the Queen Mary around in Tampa Harbor. Tugboats. Okay, I'm wrong. Wow, hope that never happens again. It's a monumental thing for self-centered alcoholics to admit they're wrong.
First time my sponsor said, look, Sandy, you're wrong. And I said, okay, you're right. No, you're wrong. I said, well, it's the same thing. We'll say it. It wouldn't come out.
So I was wrong about spirituality. And so is everybody who never gave it a fair chance. That's all that's required. Can you suddenly come from a stubborn no to a maybe? Could I possibly begin to actually allow myself to think that there could be a power greater than myself that would make its presence known to me personally, not through somebody else, not through some minister telling me that this power exists, but to actually experience it? There's a big difference between knowing about a spiritual power and experiencing it. There was, I don't know if I have time for, yeah, I got time. There was this story about sociologists, and they were going to, they found, I'll make it long story short. They found a lost tribe in a cave system that had been there. They didn't know anything about modern civilization. And the sociologist, for a change, decided to take 10 or 20 years to bring these people into the modern world instead of bringing TV in that day, because the shock would be so different. And they were in this cave system, and they had fires, and they were able to fish, but they'd never been outside, and they just saw, they knew about fire and eating. So they started explaining the outside world, and they started learning how to speak in their language, and they're teaching people English. And this process is going on, and they decided that one of the most important things that they would have to teach them about was electricity. Because when they came out, they were going to see elevators going up and down and lights going on. And, you know, everything in the world is powered in one way or another by electricity. So they were deciding what was the best way of teaching people about electricity. And there were two schools of thought. And the two schools remind me of the AA way of teaching about spirituality and the church way. So number one way was, we're going to slowly educate them out of textbooks about electricity. We're going to start with ohms and watts and resistance, and it's going to take years. It's going to take years, but eventually we could get a few people up to maybe the sophomore in college level of electricity, and then have them take a test and would know, yes, they understand electricity. Now, that was method number one. Now, method number two was a little simpler than that. They decided, why don't we put a generator outside and we'll run a wire in and we'll bring an electric lamp in and we'll connect the lamp and we'll hand them a bulb and we'll say, turn the bulb in the socket. And then what's going to happen? All of a sudden, boom, there's going to be light. And they're going to say, you see that? That's electricity. Now, we want to show you one more thing about electricity. So they unscrewed the bulb and they said, now, stick your finger in the socket. And he did, yo! That is sort of personal experience with electricity as opposed to a theory about its alleged existence. AA fits in the second category in the experiment with spirituality. We use the steps in order to get you to stick your finger in the light socket, and then you personally experience something. And you can call it anything that you want. But that's what the second step is designed to do, is to enable us to have a personal relationship, a personal awareness, and it returns us to sanity. Now, sanity, and I'm going to close with this, sanity is described as soundness of mind. But I'll tell you what I think it means. I think that until a human being experiences the actual awareness of their own creator, they're all insane, because they are seeing the world in a way that isn't true, that is simply manufactured, that is made up by our ego. And we live in this frightening place where there's no higher power. We're not even aware of it. It's just a rumor. And when this happens, the power comes in to enable us to see how wonderful people are, to see how wonderful AA is. We suddenly look around and go, look, all these other people are just like me. I am part of AA. I'm not apart from AA. I'm a part of it. And that awareness, that little awakening, is the beginning of no longer existing apart from the universe, our friends, and our higher power. We find out that the only problem we have, according to Chuck C., and I'll talk about this a lot later on, is conscious separation from God, our fellow human beings, and the universe. We actually believe that we exist apart from all this, and it's very frightening. And as this energy comes in, we realize that we don't exist apart from, but we are part of. Isn't it funny that apart, as one word, means separated from, and when it's two words, it means part of. So rather than being apart, we are a part of. And when you become a part of something instead of you're it, it's a beautiful place to live. Okay, we're at the end of the time, and I thank you for your attention, and we'll just stand in place and wrap it up with the Lord's Prayer. Thank you.